This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. I'm C.P. Leslie, the host of New Books in Historical Fiction, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today I'm speaking with Robin Oliveira about her latest novel, A Wild and Heavenly Place. It's difficult to imagine anything less heavenly, although in a sense it could be considered wild, than late 19th century Glasgow. Even today, Glasgow is still an industrial city, but the slums and tenements of the Victorian era are long gone. A Wild and Heavenly Place opens with a description of the bad old days. 1878 to 1879, Glasgow, Scotland. Is it fearful to think that in many cases, large tenements of overcrowded houses were visited by fever from top to bottom, and in some instances, not a family, and some scarcely an individual, escaped the disease? A simple-minded person would at once inquire why such places were allowed to exist in the midst of our advanced civilization. Would it be offensive to reply that these, quote, tenements of death and hell, unquote, as they have been called, are owned by Christian gentlemen, who make a comfortable living by letting them to their heathen brethren, who might also be Christians if it were not for their poverty, their moral debasement, their numerical concentration, and their consequent horrible surroundings? Glasgow Herald. And now, please join me in welcoming Robin Oliveira. Hi, Robin. Thank you for agreeing to talk with me today.
Hi, Carolyn. Thank you for inviting me.
A Wild and Heavenly Place is your fourth novel. How did you get started writing fiction?
I was a college major in Russian. I did that because I love language. But before that, I was a reader. I spent my childhood and my teenagehood reading and then through my 20s and 30s reading. When I graduated with Russian, I suddenly discovered it was the middle of the 70s and I didn't want to work for the army. And there was, as a translator, there was no other possible way to make a living. So I became a nurse, which I absolutely adored doing. I was an ICU and bone marrow transplant nurse. But from there, I had children. And when it was time for the kid, the last one to go to school, I thought, well, I could either go back to nursing, which I loved, or I could try to make one of those things that I loved, which was a book. And luckily, I got sort of the go-ahead from my spouse who said we were okay financially. And I started teach myself how to write, and finally ended up at an MFA program where I really learned the basic structure of how to write a novel. And that was how it happened. It was really born of a love of reading.
As you mentioned, you were a Russian major in college, and you even studied at the Pushkin Institute, but your fiction is mostly about either the 19th century United States or, in the case of I Always Loved You, France. Why is that?
Well, I was actually going to write a book using my Russian, and I was going to set it in early 20th century France, Paris, and then Moscow right before the revolution. But two things happened. Amor Towles wrote A Gentleman in Moscow, and that was kind of a hard act to follow. And then the other thing that happened is that while I was doing the research for that novel, trying to figure out why a young woman in Paris would move to Moscow, what the kind of man how old she would be, what kind of man she would meet that would make her go there, I went down a rabbit hole and discovered that the age of consent in the United States up until the year 1886 was the age of 10. And I didn't know that. And I thought that a lot of people had forgotten that. So I dropped this idea of a novel set in Russia. And I went back to the United States to investigate that little known fact. So that's why I have stayed here, mostly. And then, of course, this novel, A Wild and Heavenly Place, begins in Scotland.
What can you tell us about those first three novels? Oh, you talked a little bit about the one in France, but the two in the United States.
Yes. So My Name is Mary Sutter is my first novel. It was about nursing and medicine in the Civil War. I started that novel because I had an appearance. There's no other way to describe it, and it has never happened to me before or since, but I was dusting my dining room, and a young woman appeared to me. She was in period dress. She had medical books behind her. She was looking through a microscope. It was night. It was dark. She was had a candle beside her, and that set me on the trail of investigating who this woman might be. And it turned out she was a midwife who wanted to be a physician in during the time of the Civil War. And that's how that whole novel started. And it follows the path of, there were in fact 17 young women who became physicians out of their experiences in the Civil War. So I imagined my way through that one. My second novel, set in France, is about the Impressionists in Paris, mostly in the late 19th century. I thought that was very interesting because I have always loved Edgar Degas. So I wrote a novel about all the Impressionists, how they interacted, and Mary Cassatt being the first American invited into the Impressionist circle. And then finally, Winter Sisters, as I described, is about that little known fact of the age of consent being so young. And so I investigated that appalling fact and wrote an entire novel around it using a few of the characters from My Name is Mary Sutter.
You mentioned in your author's note that A Wild and Heavenly Place was inspired by a house. Tell us about the house.
Okay, so this is actually no longer an intact house. They're ruins of a house. I, with my family, have visited the San Juan Islands north of Seattle, about 70, 80 miles north of Seattle, for about 40 years. And we biked all over the islands. And one day we were sort of down a private road, and there were the ruins of this gorgeous old stone house, still sort of intact. You can see some of the structures. The walls are still up. It was obviously a house that had been made with love, and it was unlike anything else on the island. And I thought, okay, so who built that house? Why? And I thought then that I was absolutely going to put that novel, that those ruins, in a novel one day. And so I did. And that's how that book started.
And how did Samuel and Haley come into being as a result of that inspiration?
Well, as I said, I wonder who built that house and why. I really couldn't find anything about the history. It was very difficult. So I dreamed a history for it. And to note, I did move the location of it from its current place to where it takes place, where it situates itself in the novel, in order to which is for story purposes. But in addition to that, I had long wanted to write a continents-spanning epic love story. And so I decided to include those ruins and invent who might have built them. From there, I focused on who built it and why. And Samuel Fittis was born. His physiognomy, his physical features are modeled on the son of a friend of mine. But who he was rooted in integrity. Basically, I wanted to write about a young man of integrity who modeled his whole life on that basic characteristic. Haley is not modeled. Haley McIntyre, his love interest, is not modeled after anyone. She just sprang from my imagination. But for her, the base, the core of who she was, I wondered what kind of woman, what kind of person someone would be in order to deserve the kind of devotion that Samuel exercises in the novel.
So tell us a little bit about Samuel himself, where he is in his life. You've mentioned his driving characteristic, which is, of course, for a novel character, one of the most important things. But where is he actually at the beginning of the story?
So when we meet Samuel on the first page, he is living in a tenement in Glasgow in a shared room, which was very frequent then, near sort of the pestilential train station, major train station in Glasgow. He is a very intelligent young man. He is an orphan. He was orphaned after disease killed all but one member of his family. And he has stolen his little sister, Allison, away from the orphanage where they were both interred after the rest of his family dies of diphtheria. That orphanage, Smilum Orphanage, is an historical orphanage. It closed, I think, in 1986. And there was a huge investigation into what occurred at that orphanage, which was an abundant amount of cruelty. So using that and using actual witness testimony, I created an orphanage from which Samuel has no choice but to steal his now 5-year-old sister away from that. So they are alone, poverty-stricken. He is obviously a protector. He cares for Allison by shoveling coal. He and she are both hungry. He is stuck in his poverty due to the class system in Scotland.
And how do he and Allison run into Haley McIntyre, whose living conditions at the beginning are so different from theirs?
Samuel and Allison attend the same church as Haley. At that time, classes were separated by floors. The wealthy purchase their pews on the main floor of the synagogue or the church, while the poor are relegated to the crowded mezzanine above. And Samuel situates himself in the front just so that he can watch Haley. He has had his eye on her from the first moment he saw her. At the time of the novel, it's been about a month. He is just attracted to her. She's beautiful, but he can't cross the class barrier. He's impoverished. He hardly has clothes. He's dirty from the coal shoveling, no matter how clean he makes himself. But on the day that they finally meet, Haley McIntyre's little brother, Geordie, has drifted into the street to watch some children playing a football game, soccer game, in the middle of the street after church because the sun has come out, rarely in Scotland. And he is just about to be run over by a runaway wagon. And Samuel, who has been keeping an eye on him, darts into the street and scoops him up and saves him from the path of the wagon. At that point, the McIntyre family is grateful to him, but Haley more so, and she pesters her parents to ask Samuel and Allison to dinner.
So introduce us to her, where she is in her life, what kind of person she is, what she wants, to the extent that she knows the answer to that question, because she's only a teenager.
Haley is the daughter of a wealthy coal mining engineer named Harold McIntyre and his wife, Davinia, who live in Glasgow's Upper Crest West End. Haley is curious. She's very kind. She's a bit of a rebel. She vaguely wants a different life from her mother's social one, which is focused on social standing and balls and dinners. But Haley cannot yet vocalize specifically the life she's after. She cares for her younger brother, pays much more attention to him than her mother does. She dabbles in charitable work. She is not snobbish. But beyond that, she isn't quite certain of what she wants. But when she meets Samuel, she learns she wants one thing. She wants him.
And what draws them together, despite this social gap?
Well, this is a bit of a Romeo and Juliet-esque story. And much like those two, they are just instantly attracted to one another. After all, they're young and they have hormones. But at the dinner table at the McIntyre household, Haley just really likes Samuel's intelligence. She likes how he is respectful of her father. She likes how he stands up a bit to her mother. She likes his devotion to his sister, Allison. She admires his intelligence. On his part, however, he never questions his affection and love for Haley. It's an instant, indelible attraction, but of course on her part, her intelligence and her kindness stand out. He has had this idea of hope, really, and somehow, in a way that's not quite explainable even to himself, Haley embodies that sense of hope.
It's perhaps not surprising that Haley's parents, especially her mother, Davinia, aren't much in favor of their daughter's friendship with Samuel and Allison. What do they want for her, and what do we need to know about them as individuals to understand the story?
Well, they like many parents, want for her of that time. They want a life of ease for her and of social standing and social connection, of wealth and safety. Harold McIntyre is a very kind man. He is very thoughtful. He is very close to his daughter. He has sort of encouraged a little bit of rebelliousness on her part. He likes her. He likes how she engages with him. But there's something not quite right about him, and perhaps we'll talk about this later. But Harold McIntyre is suffering from a great deal of guilt over a coal mining explosion in his recent past. Haley's mother, Davinia, is conventional. On some way, she is superficial, she is strict, she is snobbish, and she does everything the right way. And Samuel is certainly not the right way to her way of thinking.
How would you describe Haley's relationship with her parents?
So she's very close to her father, as I said. She is less close to her mother. She will also soon be keeping a secret from them in the way that teenagers do. And I would say that you might even say that she is managing them. She sees them for who they are. She tries to protect her father from her mother's growing disdain for her father's not quite rightness. And she is just trying very hard to have the sort of her non-specific life yet as she wants to live it, as teenagers do.
Things take an abrupt turn when Harold McIntyre suffers a sudden financial loss. Is there anything you can tell us about that?
Yes. So when I write novels, historical fiction, I try very hard to put my characters right in the midst of the real world at that time. And one of the ways I do that is that I read newspapers of the time in order to see what local events, what international events might influence their lives. It's a way of taking people back in time and making them believe that these characters, which are fictional, are real. So I was doing the research for the novel, trying to figure out what might impact them, when I read that in 1878, the city of Glasgow Bank failed. And that failure impacted all of Scotland. It impacted financiers and investors and ordinary folks. So many people lost money. Every penny was gone through these ill-advised overseas investors. It plunged Glasgow into an economic depression for years. The directors of the bank underwent trial and were convicted of fraud. And so many people lost money that I thought that a man of Harold McIntyre's stature might be impacted by that. And so I use that historical event in order to as a plot point, essentially, in order to force the McIntyres to make a decision about their lives.
As you mentioned, Harold has this deep sense of guilt within him because of this past incident that he feels responsible for. Tell us how it feeds into his reaction to his sudden financial loss.
So, as I said, I use historical events, and the year before, in a place called High Blantyre, which is about 30 miles from Glasgow, there was a devastating coal explosion. Investigations into that incident showed that someone used an open frame. The atmospheric conditions were such that that the interior of the coal mine itself had a great deal of damp or methane gas in it. And someone struck a match, and 212 men and boys were killed in this devastating explosion. And so Harold McIntyre's company owns that coal mine. And that instance of, he's a coal engineer, he sort of oversaw the whole enterprise. He felt guilty in a way that was probably too much guilt for what happened, but it has rattled him so deeply that he is unsure of himself. He is on edge. He feels very badly. He can only think about the people whose lives were impacted, and he is carrying a huge sense of guilt that nothing that he does, nothing that his friends say, nothing that the investigations say that says that it wasn't his fault can assuage his feelings of failure and of responsibility. And so the two events combined act on Harold McIntyre in a way that is impossible to turn back. He has a fundamental change of personality and a fundamental change of purpose in his life.
Even so, his solution to his problems is a bit surprising, even extreme. What does he decide, and how do his family members react to it?
So Harold McIntyre has learned that far away across the world is a city named Seattle, and in its hills are coal. And he decides that he is going to take his family there with what little money he has left. And so in a sort of a heart of darkness Conrad situation, they embark on this journey halfway around the world. So the mother goes along, Davinia goes along, because she really has no other option. She can stay in Glasgow and be impoverished and lose all her social standing, which she finds completely intolerable. So she goes along, but her fury has increased. She's been a little upset with her husband, but now she's furious and she is in rebellion almost the whole time as they go. Haley, in a sort of surprising turn, takes on her father's characteristic of sort of oversized guilt. She has secretly been meeting Samuel, and she suddenly feels the guilt of that, the deception that she has been perpetrating on her parents, and she withdraws from Samuel. She's been using the family's carriage, which they can no longer afford. She's just carrying this terrible guilt. Geordie, of course, knows nothing about it. When Haley and Samuel part, she tells Samuel where they're going to Washington Territory, she says, not quite imploring him, but informing him in some unstated purpose, hoping that he will follow her, but she receives no confirmation back from Samuel.
And Samuel's life has been improving, and consequently his sister's life has been improving. Tell us about his new job and the talents it reveals in him.
So Samuel's dinner visit to the McIntyres awakens him from the kind of survival trance he's been in. So he immediately goes hunting for a job in a shipyard, hoping to make ships because that's really his dream. And he stumbles one evening into a shipbuilding office where, while he's waiting, he spots a mathematical error that are laid out in these blueprints. And he points it out to the architect, who in another room is desperately trying to find where the problem is that he knows there's a problem, but he can't find it. And Samuel points it out. Hathaway, the architect there, when he receives this information from Samuel, gives Samuel a job redrawing or copying drafts. And this knowledge is what will equip him later for his trip to Seattle. But he, it gives Samuel this sort of repetitive ability to understand how large ships are built. And he is, you know, he's a bit of a mathematical genius. He has this skill of being able to see things that other people can't see. And this will give him what he needs for his later occupation.
The McIntyre family sets sail for the United States. Neither the journey nor the destination quite meets their expectations. In what ways?
Well, first off, all they can afford is second class, which they've never traveled in before. Geordie becomes extremely ill on the ship. Mrs. McIntyre resents her husband, and she is separating both from her children and her husband. She's basically useless. And Mr. McIntyre's mental and emotional state deteriorates further. So they are sort of impoverished in a way on the journey over, impoverished in their own estimation. But when they arrive in Seattle, it is a nothing town. There's about 3,000 people in it. It is made entirely of wood. At that time, Glasgow was an elegant city. It still is, with gorgeous stone buildings, lots of architecture, beautifully paved streets. The streets in Seattle are unpaved. It is as opposite a place as they could find in the universe to go to from what they knew and understood. And they are impoverished there as well. So they can't even afford the crude but best hotel in town. So they are flung to the lower classes almost immediately.
Samuel doesn't follow them at first, despite Haley's hints. But what changes his mind?
After working in the shipbuilder's office for a while, Samuel is relocated to the shipyard where he's apprenticed to a man named Billy John, and he learns how to build dinghies. And during that process, Samuel is still thinking, even though he's been told that he needs a university degree, which he cannot afford, that he thinks he will be able to go up in the ranks, but he can't. Scotland is a country built on class at that time, and he can't break through. And John assures him, you'll be building dinghies for the rest of your life. Samuel appeals again to the ship's architect, he's turned down. He told him there's no chance. And the other thing is that one day, Allison comes home ill. Allison works in a textile factory where she has to work because they have no money. She comes home very ill, and the combination of these two things, not being able to ever escape their poverty and Allison being ill, you know, raising again the fears that he might lose her the way he lost the rest of his family, is the thing that tips him over the edge. So it's really a combination of three things. It's a chance of opportunity, not knowing really, Allison's illness, and this chance of maybe seeing Haley if he goes to Washington Territory where he hopes he will be able to find her.
And how does his journey with Allison differ from the McIntyres?
Well, it cost about £20 a person then to go in steerage just to New York. And then from New York, it would take even more money to go all the way down through the Panama Isthmus and crossing that by train, and then up the very long west coast of the Americas up into Seattle. He doesn't have the money. So he hides Allison away in a little closet on the steamer, where he is hired to, again, once again, shovel coal. And he shovels coal all the way across to New York. And from there, he finds another job shoveling coal. He shovels coal all the way to Seattle. And at one point, although he has tried to hide Allison, she is also forced to work to clean to make up for her passageway, to pay for her way. Samuel and Allison's journey, there is one more obstacle, and that is that there's a near disaster at sea where Samuel's ability as a shipbuilder come into play, and we understand how excellent he is at what he does. But it is a laborious, difficult journey. And by the time they're done, Samuel is extremely, I would say he's physically fit, beautifully physically fit. Allison is finding hope and finding friends on the boat. And that's how they arrive in Seattle.
So we're probably close to the point where we don't want to give too much away. And you've already told us a bit about what Seattle was like. And the surrounding countryside is also a place for your characters to spend some time. But tell us a bit about the research that you did. Were there a lot of sources available for this story? Did you have to prune information to fit the story?
Well, One of the reasons I like to write about the 19th century is the abundance of information. And there was for this, although I ran into the pandemic while I was trying to write the book. And so it was very difficult to get into some of the city archives that I needed to. But I first began by going to Scotland and walked the streets of Glasgow just to understand exactly where everything was, what it felt like, what it smelled like. I took a train through the Scottish countryside to understand that as well. I got the lay of the land. And really, it was mostly a geographic exploration when I was there. For Seattle, and taking that trip, you know, I always use as much as possible ships, timetables. My characters go on the use the public transportation that's printed in the newspaper, so I understand exactly what kind of ship they're on. They are subject to the forces of the world that they're in, so I always use that information. But then, you know, I use city directories. There are these wonderful old city directories, like old telephone books, where I can figure out which business was where, and I use old maps as well. I studied, you know, scholarly articles on coal, the demographics of who was who in Seattle, particularly the Chinese, who were very important to Seattle's being built. I look at the census, so I know exactly what nationalities were in Seattle and also in Newcastle, which is a coal mining town outside of Seattle. And speaking of that, I live on Cougar Mountain in Seattle, which is where part of this story takes place. And there are coal mines throughout the entire mountain. And there's an historical society that has done great primary research, and they were very generous with me. And one of them tromped all over the mountain with me several times, finding entrances to the mines, explaining where the town was. I used documents that they shared with me. They have a wonderful book. So I was able to pretty much get the lay of the physical land. And then I studied coal mining textbooks so that I could understand exactly how coal was mined in Seattle in the 19th century. I read about shipbuilding. My husband and I happened to be building a boat at the same time as this book was being written, so I could understand some of what Samuel was doing, and I was trying very hard to convey the realities of that and do it in a way that would be completely historically accurate. My husband and I have traveled all over Puget Sound and into the San Juan Islands on our boat, and so I was able to see the land from the water in a way that I hadn't seen, and it matters in this novel. The ocean, the Puget Sound, the Salish Sea all matter in this novel. So it's a multi-pronged approach to get as, I'd like my history to be as accurate as possible. And if I change something, I always note it in my author's note, but my research is pretty meticulous, just because I think that doing that adds to the verisimilitude and helps readers get transported back in time effortlessly.
Are there any other characters or incidents that you'd especially like to share with the listeners?
Well, there's one in particular. His name is Press Loving. He has a son named John Salvation. I sent my editor a novel of 145,000 words. It is now about 106,000 words. So I had to compress Press Loving and John Salvation's story. They're very important to me. They're two African-American characters. We haven't talked much about theme in this conversation. So for me, you know, sometimes you can't tell what the theme of the novel is as you're writing it, but I soon came to understand that it was about home. Where is home? How do you find home? Who is home? And Press Loving and John Salvation had a much deeper, longer story based on that, because Press Loving was a former slave and John Salvation was born free. And so I liked that idea of what home and also what freedom meant to characters who were born under different circumstances. So I'm playing with that all through the novel, and that's it's kind of important to me that is something. I hope it's something that came across.
And is that what you would like people to take away from A Wild and Heavenly Place, or is there something else?
Well, there is that. It's very important, but by this time now, it's the reader's book by now. You hope that it's all on the page as an author. That said, I am always delighted when I hear that readers have learned something of history. I think people read historical fiction because they like to know history, but they like to absorb it in this sort of skewed way where it's just part of what the characters are living through. And in this case, it's early Seattle and it's coal mining history and the geography of the region and its beauty. But mostly, I hope that they really revel in the love story.
Are you already working on another book?
I'm thinking about another book. This book took about 4 to 5 years to write, and I know that seems like a long time, but there was a pandemic in there, and I traveled for the research, and then it just took longer because of the difficulty of getting documents. So I always take a little break between books. I have another book in mind. It too is. Place is really important to me. It's in the title of this novel, A Wild and Heavenly Place, and this too involves a place that has been important to me in my life.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your time with us today, Robin. I really enjoyed talking with you.
Well, Carolyn, it was delightful. Thank you so much.
And thank you for listening to our podcast. Once again, I am C.P. Leslie, the host of New Books in Historical Fiction, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. And today I've been talking with Robin Oliveira about A Wild and Heavenly Place. Find out more about her at robinoliveira.com. Like us on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok at New Books Network. You can find out more about me and my books at cplezzi.com, where I blog about the interviews and in general discuss history, historical fiction, and the rapidly changing publishing industry. Goodbye until my next conversation about historical fiction on the New Books Network.